Hi there, everyone. Ian here. Lovely Monday night on the Sunshine Coast with lots of rain. Don't know where the Sunshine Coast got its name from because it rains a lot here. So got a few questions that have come in during the time. Just remember these questions that we're answering right up have been emailed in. They've been emailed in to questions@realestatesuccess.com.au. That's questions@realestatesuccess.com.au. You can ask questions, obviously, live. There's a question tab down on your control panel. You can see questions there and you're able to ask questions. And obviously, I'll answer those as I go through. First thing is to answer these ones that have come in online on by email. So remember that I am a plumber and builder by trade, and anything that I say here is my opinion. I'm not qualified to give advice, and you can't use this information on your personal circumstances. You need to go off and find people who are qualified and can give you the correct advice. So that's my small disclaimer to start with. And let's start with the questions. Hi, can you please clarify what do you mean by lifting the title and the difference with subdivision? Okay, I think I answered this last time, but essentially what you've got is back in the old days when land was not scarce and there was lots of it around, and you find it a lot in regional towns as well, when the subdivision formally took place originally, someone came along and says, oh, look, I want to buy a block of land. And the developer says, you know what? You know, we've got lots of land here and we don't think we'll sell it all. I can give you two lots really cheap. And the owner would go, yeah, fair enough, let's buy them. What they would do, the developer would then just make a title for the two lots. And the reason that they'd make one title for the two lots is simply because it's cheaper to keep. Because if you've got two titles and two lots, the council fees are more expensive and all the rest of it. So they bought two lots and they went and bought a house and, you know, hopefully you can find one. I was having a look in one of our students' ones today that they've found one that's on two lots, and hopefully they haven't built a house or just the carport or something is sticking across the lot. So by removing the carport, if you've got the house sitting over the top, you're going to have to move the house or knock the house down. But the process of lifting the title is you take the title generally to a surveyor or town planner, and they will then make the application to the Lands Titles Office to lift the title. So you'll have one title, two lots. You take it to the Lands Titles Office. You say, look, I want to split that title now. Now, remember, the subdivision has already taken place back when the original land chop-up happened. So you're technically not needing a subdivision, although you do need to provide power and water and everything. So that has to be done before you can lift the title. So you might need to talk to the council about getting water connections and sewer connections and stormwater and all that. So then you go to the Lands Titles Office. You go, I've got one title, two lots. I want two titles, two lots, please. Could you lift that title for me? They'll create a separate piece of paper. So now you've got two pieces of paper or two titles that you're holding on. So it's technically not a subdivision because the subdivision has already occurred. It's already been approved. There are a few around, and I might just quickly try one. Let's see, Google Maps and see if we can just quickly find something in Brisbane that will have that. Now, I like the new look of Google Maps because it gives you where the houses are sitting and it gives you a better opportunity to go down and look at the boundaries and where the boundaries sit according to the houses. So where I wanted to be, Sunshine Coast. We might come back to it, I think. Here we go. Let's see. Here we are in Brisbane. Let's see if we can find something that's worth looking at as far as lots and titles. So I'm just waiting. Now, that's the other thing I'd like to mention too. I don't have any control over my I'm at Indipner's office here. I don't have any control of the internet connection here, and I have no control of the connection that you've got at your end. So it's going to drop out a little bit. I might change over. Yeah, come on. I mean, that will be a bit better. And I'll have a bit quicker. Just let me check some questions here because you may. All right, my connection should be a lot better now. Hopefully. Yeah, sorry about that. So I've got a different connection point now. Hopefully we've got better internet. So if we zoom in closer now into Google Maps and it updates, hopefully we can see some split titles. Okay, so I will look around here. And the reason I look at Brisbane is because there's a lot in Brisbane that are over two titles. They have the standard 809 square meter block. And they make two blocks of 405. So here's a classic example. Here you've got number 17, where you've got the block outline here, and it's sitting across two. Now, with that one, it'd be too hard to lift title because you'd have to knock down a building. Oh, yeah, I mean, it might be worthy of doing it. And so have a look at it. So just let me clear my questions because I realized that the questions were coming in was because I had a really bad connection. So just let me clear them. Jackie Campbell, if you've got a question, write it in. Bring it in to me here. I keep losing sound. Sound has gone. Can't hear anything. Fair enough. All right, Stephen Teen, can you just send me something in and tell me that it's all better now? Okay, all right, so the first answer was no. Okay, so lifting title, let's go back to that. So when it goes to, when we're talking about lifting title, we're talking about someone that bought two lots of land way back, and they only had one title over the two lots simply because it's cheaper in council fees. You buy that property, you make sure that there's nothing encroaching over the middle boundary, and then you go and ask the land's titles person to lift it for you. So they, what they do is, okay, I get the message, it's better. Don't need to tell me anymore. So what you do is you do have to provide water and power and making sure that the connections are possible for that block of land. Then what you do is you go and you ask a surveyor or town planner. They take it to the land's titles office. They tell the land's titles office that we've got two lots of land. The subdivision has already occurred way back then when the land was put together. Now we've got two lots and one title. I want two titles with two lots. So I need two pieces of paper, please. Now your bank may need to be involved in that if there's a mortgage on it because you're splitting their asset up, and that needs to be told to them as well. So it's technically not a subdivision because the subdivision has already occurred. Hi, Ian. I have a question that relates to tax rate. The idea of a bucket company is to pay 30% tax on profit made it rather than 45% if you're a high income earner. If I withdraw the funds for personal use, treat it as dividend. Okay, so let's get the first part of this correct. So let's say you go and set up, you know, you've got your companies and trusts all over and they all own property and they're nicely positive geared and they're paying you a wage. It makes sense that at some point in time, you stop paying the highest tax bracket and you shift money across to a bucket company that pays 30% in the dollar. And the 70 cents in the dollar, you can then lend back to the other trusts or buy another property with it. And it would be a loan arrangement between the bucket company and the new company and trust. Now, that's if you were using it for business. Now, remember, the tax rates have changed and you need to look up the ATO website. Essentially, they've dropped from I'll get you to look them up. But essentially, my tax bracket is, lifted significantly higher, that it's no longer 46 cents in the dollar, it's generally 37 cents in the dollar. So your argument's got to be which way you went. But let's just say that we did put money into the bucket company, it got paid at 30 cents in the dollar. Now, the question here says, if I withdraw the funds for personal use and treat it as a dividend, then I need to pay tax as franked dividends. So another 30% is applied. Well, that's not correct. So in total, I pay 60% tax. That's not correct. So let's just say that we are in the current tax rates and that your income tax is 37 cents in the dollar. So you've shifted money across to your, a couple of years ago, you shifted some money across, profits across, or dividends, some earnings across to the bucket company. You paid 30 cents in the dollar. So that's tax paid money sitting there in the bucket company. A couple of years down the track, you say, look, I wouldn't mind buying, dare I say it, I wouldn't mind buying a new car. As long as you're in the position to do that, you say to the bucket company, actually, can I have some of that money, that tax-paid money that's sitting in the account, can I have that? And so you're saying that to yourself, essentially. So you withdraw money out of the bucket company. Let's say it's a $70,000 car, okay? So you take $70,000 out to pay for the car. Now, your current tax rate at the time that you do it is 37 cents in the dollar. Now, remember, you've already paid 30 cents in the dollar at the company tax rate. So when you withdraw that money as a dividend to you personally, you have to pay the difference between 30 cents in the dollar and 37 cents in the dollar. So you'll be paying 7 cents in the dollar for that 70,000. So you're not doubling your tax. You're actually, you know, you're just paying the difference. Now, remember, you might have a really bad year. And you decide that, you know, you don't have any income coming in at all, that money that's sitting in your bucket company, you could distribute to yourself as a dividend and you wouldn't have to pay any tax on it if your tax rate wasn't above the 30 cents. So I think that answers that question. Just let me check some questions here. Okay, no worries. No questions that I can see yet. Well, that I'll answer later. Okay, Ian, I'm an architect, full-time employee, and I'd like to start the transition into being independent by having my income from manufacturing growth and small developments. Which is the best structure to have in order to produce this income during 2 years until I'm ready to leave work so I can prove to financial institutions that I already created an income equivalent to what I have now being as an employee? Okay, so let's, I'll go on. The idea is that a trust or company can apply for the loans and not me as individual. That's not correct. The new company and trust that you create to buy a property will be the one that goes for the loans. Now, every company and trust will be going for the loan. You'll be the guarantor for the loan as an individual. That doesn't break your asset protection. All you're doing is guaranteeing the loan. So, and Dipner says, you know, one house, one company, one trust. So is it a trust with a corporate trustee? Yes, it is how Dipner would teach you to set up a business. If I have to distribute all profits before each end of financial year, how does it work? Does this trust still provide the income, or is it in a company that one I have to have? So company would be not the one that you want. Company has too much liability in it as a director. There's lots of issues around that. So there's another question related to this. So I'll take you back to our example of me and Christine and I should say. So we've got a corporate trustee and trust. Corporate trustee is $2 shelf company. So it has $2 shares. And we've got a development trust that sits underneath it. Now, all our trading as a development company is underneath there. So I'm employed by my trust to go off and work for the other trusts. So if I go off to the ABC Proprietary Limited as trustee for the ABC Trust House and I do work on it, then the development trust will bill that trust over there for the work that I've done. Now, I'm an employee to my trust. I get paid super. I have workers' compensation, all of that that's created around that. Now, the unfortunate part of all this is that it doesn't matter whether I'm earning the same wage as a salary or same wage through my trust. They will still say, ultimately, who is the owner and who runs this trust? And they'll say, it's Ian and Christine, in which case they would consider that self-employment. So the one thing that, you know, I do during Fast Profits, I go through a section of going pro, the transition of coming out of work and going into, so coming out of full-time employment and going into passive geared employment. And the issue you've got is that it was only recently that we could go back to banks and get the same, the full amount of loans that we would expect to have got when we're in a salary. So my wage at TAFE was $120,000 when I left. And essentially we had to go to $240,000 of passive income before the banks would start to look at us again. And it's a double-edged sword, because when what you're talking about here, now I didn't choose to do it that way, and I run through that in Fast Profits, but what you're talking about here, Fabi, is that you're an architect and you're a full-time employee. So I'm just going to use round numbers here. Let's say that you earn $100,000 as a salary. Now that's a good salary, that's a good serviceability, the banks will love you, right? You're employed by someone else. Then you decide over the time to build up your income so that you've got $100,000 worth of passive geared income coming into you through your trust, and it's being paid to you and all that sort of stuff. The double-edged sword here is that at that point in time, you're actually earning double the amount of money that you would normally earn. So you've got $100,000 coming out of your salary and $100,000. Now, if you're not very careful, you can actually change your living, and your cost of living will increase, and you chew through money pretty quickly. Chris and I just went through a whole financial budget check of where our money was being spent, and we were quite surprised about how we had increased unknowingly, just, you know, through extra coffees and extra lunches and whatever, how much extra money we were spending. So, you know, in this part of our life where we're accumulating wealth, we were pulling back on that and going, hang on, we don't need to do that right now. We can do that later on. So, and I'm not saying that I don't take her out anymore. I do love her and she's a fantastic woman. But so you've now got a double income. So come the point in time. So what I would be doing in that case is, yes, by all means, pay yourself a wage coming out of that for 2 years so that you've got good tax returns. But that wage, I would be smashing down my personal debt as much as I could with that money. And I wouldn't use it for anything else other than pulling your debt down as much as you could. Now, when it comes to banks, your $100,000 salary income is really good. Your $100,000 of self-employed trust income will be looked at about half the rate with most lenders. And that's the unfortunate part of what we do in business. So you're going to have to double the amount of money you earn in passive income if you want to continue to get loans. Now you might say, I've got $100,000 of passive income coming in. That's enough for me. I've done my work. I'm going to sit back now. I'm going to sit on the comfy couch and just take in the 100 and not worry about getting any more loans. If you want to continue to go getting loans, you're going to have to either set up joint ventures, or you're going to have to make sure that you've got more income than your salary. And that's, you know, that's the big white elephant, unfortunately. Hi, in a few webinars, you explain the structure you use to perform your development. So discretionary trust with a corporate trustee on top. This does not buy properties. That's correct. This development trust employs and pays you to perform and do work on the properties purchased by other trusts. That's correct. What is the advantage in having this trust rather than a company that employs you? So company, again, the trust has got some asset protection. If you're a licensee like I am, so I've got a builder's license and a plumber's license, you know, I'm not ever protected in that I could end up with doing some work that blows someone up. And if I'm liable, then they'll come after me regardless, right? Now, in our development trust, there is no value in there, okay? The only thing that's in there is trading. So when it comes to my truck and my excavators and all the other components that we own that in a separate structure. So if you owned a company and you were the director of a company and someone came after you, so if I was negligent and I did something and they came after me, they could take whatever's in the trust. They could take anything that's in my personal name. They wouldn't be able to go generally and shift across and take all my equipment out of my equipment trust. Now, in a company, though, you're a director. You're liable. There's extra liabilities that carry with that. And if you held all your machinery and stuff in another company as well, well, you'd be a director of that and you'd be up for grabs on that. So Dipner says there's a number of reasons why you do it, but company and a discretionary trust underneath it. So corporate trustee and discretionary trust is the way that you should run a business. Hi, Ian. I have two questions here. Me and my husband are about to set up trust structures, but in terms of the loan serviceability, it is better to use one of us as director instead of both of us for trust. So the next deal, we can use the other one as a director in another structure. So we won't be both liable for one loan. Okay. This is a good question, actually, because, and they're all good questions. This is something that we went through recently, because when you've got two parts, so when you've got a partnership, a spouse, and so a husband and wife, if they're both on really good income and they both can stand up on their own to a bank loan, I wouldn't go putting both of them in as beneficiaries or as directors at a company. Now, Christine and I, so now we don't need Christine on loans anymore, so we'd put my name on all the loans. Now, when the trust structure is set up, what you do is you put husband and wife as appointers of the trust. That means that you're both decision makers. And then you'd put one of the, so let's say you put the husband as the director and the beneficiary of that trust. And in the next one, you'd put the wife as the beneficiary and the director. And again, they'd both be appointers. Now, the reason you'd put both of you down as appointers is because if one of you passes away or can't sign documents or whatever, you've got the other ones there to cover, right? So the reason that you would do that is, as a husband and wife, if you both put yourself down as directors and beneficiaries, if you went for a $200,000 loan, it's not $100,000 each, it's $200,000 each. And so it essentially halves your serviceability. So the more that you can keep each other apart, the better off that you are. So that's a good way to go. Question two was, is there any good landlord insurance you can recommend? Look, Investor Loans Network, head office, there is the contacts page on the website. They can put you in contact with some good insurance brokers. We're just going through all our insurances at the moment, actually, through Investor Loans Network, and they're consolidating all our properties into one insurance policy per se, so that it becomes cheaper. What would we insure during renovation period before we rent the house out? So so if you had standard rent insurance on it, you would contact your insurance company and tell them that you're renovating, because if you're renovating and something happens, they will not pay out. So they need to be aware of it. And they may say, well, we can't insure you during renovation, in which case, again, Investor Loans can help you out. Is that only building and contents insurance, or even just building insurance? Again, you just need to tell your insurance company that you are renovating and what you're doing and the extent of the renovation and how far you're going with that. And they may say, oh, no, well, we want building insurance, in which case you'll have to go and just get building insurance because there'll be no content in there unless it's a small cosmetic reno. Ian, I need one tax file number for each trust, correct? Yes. Then I can do a tax return for the property. That's correct. Now, when you do your tax return, there will be profit and loss to it, but your distributions will be there so that you're essentially the tax, that what you want to do is not pay any tax within the trust, because any money left in the bank account of the trust will have to pay tax at 46 cents, I think it is. So you want to distribute before the end of the financial year. And now is the time that you should be thinking about talking to your accountant about looking at the distribution and where that's going to go, because we're coming up to June 30, and any money sitting in your account July 1, which is a rule that changed in recent times, means that it's going to get taxed at 46 cents. So be aware of that. Do I need an ABN for each trust? Yes, I think is the answer. So once I have an ABN, I need to do a BAS, right? No. So when you do get your ABN for the trust, there is a box that you can tick that says you don't want to register for GST. So that means if you do sell the property, there's no GST involved unless it's commercial. We're talking residential here, right? So if it is commercial, it's going to have GST regardless. So you don't want to register for GST. You don't have to. There's a box that you can tick, all right? So there is no GST in residential property unless it's under certain circumstances. But in your case, if it's just a standard property, there'll be no GST. Hi, Ian. I would like some clarity on the use of the margin scheme with a house and land package and a net loss position. I purchased a house and land package in my own name, pre-DIMPNA, which was completed in November of 2013. So under the margin, so land was sold under the margin scheme, so that's fine. So I registered for GST and have claimed back the GST on the build, okay? The house is in a mining town. I am receiving a rental guarantee till December 2014, and the house is still vacant, never lived in. It's not good. I plan to wait till November 2014 and then put the house on the market. Look, we're 6 months away from that point in time, and with the correct marketing and talking to maybe a super property specialist, you might consider looking at selling it now because it's got some interior value of the lease that's in place right now. So anyway, that's my view on that part of it. The current value is less than my purchase price, so we'll likely sell at a loss. Okay, I'm with you there. So I've spoken to two accountants and they both advise that the sale will be a capital loss situation. Absolutely. So whatever losses that you make in this property will be put in as an offset for the future, and I'll explain that in a second. As I will have owned the house for 12 months, I will need to return the GST. No, that's not true. I have received and losses will be quarantined till I make a capital gain. Okay. So the GST bit about 12 months, I think you're confused. 12 months has never come into anything when it comes to GST or capital gain. But let's just presume that you've claimed GST on the build. That's fine. That's sitting in your bank account at the moment. At the back end, when you sell, you will have GST to pay. So if you sold the property for $400,000, and this is within the first 5 years, then which it is, November 2013. So when you sell it, if you sold it for $400,000, there would be $36,000 of GST that would have to be paid. So that's as simple as that works, because there's $9,000 per $100,000. So there's $36,000 need to be paid. So so when it comes to the capital loss, you can quarantine it under your own name until the next capital gain. So let's go back. So, but my understanding is that when I sell, I realize a loss and I can offset loss against my personal income because the property is in my name. That's not correct. So let's get this right. I'm going to use round figures again. Let's say that after GST and all the expenditures that you've worked out, you sell the property and there's $50,000 of capital loss in that property, right? Now, that can be quarantined in your own personal name to offset against any future gain in anything that you make, not income, any future gain. So if I went and bought a property and I did a chunk deal in my own personal name, and which is not recommended, and you made $50,000, then the offset would be that $50,000, they would take no tax out. Okay, there'd be no tax at all. If you went and sold shares at a capital gain, then you would be able to offset that against the $50,000 and there'd be no tax on the $50,000. So I hope that makes sense. So the 12 months doesn't have anything to do with it. It's just the offset on that. Hi, Dipner, Ian. I'm a Sydney dweller and was buying properties in 2009 and 10 that were great bargains. I agree, they were great bargains. There were few buyers because everyone was spooked about the GFC. There were plenty of foreclosure auctions. Prices had come down 5 to 10% and some properties were selling well below their 204 peak. I bought one house for $165,000 in 2009 that sold for $261,000 in 2004. So essentially you got a really good bargain, $100,000 discount essentially off that property. From 5 years down the track. And so that's good buying. I felt great about buying and confident that I was getting value. I'm wanting to buy one today. And in contrast, prices are all time highs. The last 9 months has seen prices increase 20% or so. And there's a lot of competition out there from other buyers. Agree totally. I'm finding it very difficult to bring myself to offer these sorts of prices for properties. And I have little sense of confidence that I'm getting value. Fair enough. How do you find bargains during times like this and be confident that you're getting value when paying all-time high prices? Okay, so let's go back to the second last point. I'm finding it difficult to bring myself to offer these sorts of prices for properties and I have little sense of confidence that I'm getting value. Your confidence has come from buying properties at low capital and them increasing in capital value. Where Dipner teaches that if you get capital growth, absolutely fantastic. What you have to do is ensure that your own manufactured growth in the properties is good doing, okay? So you've got to kick out of your mind the capital growth component, because I will show you one of my slides that I show around the country. And when it comes to that, if you bought in the worst periods of times, you are still much better off in today, society-wise, capital value-wise, than what it was back then. So just let me wait for this to load up so I can explain what I'm talking about. I'll come back. All right, just looking for the slide and they're loading up. Come on. All right, so probably this one will do it. let me take you into the slideshow here. Okay, so with this slide here, this is 1960 through to a predicted 2016 line. And the green line is a median price of Sydney and Melbourne prices. And Sydney is what we're talking about here. Now, if essentially when you look at this graph, if it's below the green line, the buying is good value. If it's above the green line, then you've paid peak price, okay? Now, you're talking about buying in 2010, which is about here, and you're saying, well, and this has moved on, okay? So I actually think the blue line's touching close to the green line at the moment. So you bought right below here when there was good value in 2009-10. Now, if, let's just say if you bought in the worst period of property in 1988 when prices skyrocketed beyond ridiculous amounts and everyone said the sky's falling and all the rest of it, if you bought then and you were relying on capital growth and you held your property right now, your property value would have more than doubled in price, right? Okay, so we've gone from 150 up to, oh, sorry, 200 up to about, you know, in 1988, you could have bought for about 200, 300. We're now at 800, 900 median price. Now, that's at the worst time you could have bought. So there's an old saying in property, the difference between a good bad and a good buy and a bad buy is about 3 years. So I would dare say that you need to look at what you can manufacture in growth on your property. Create your own capital growth by doing something. Make sure that you can subdivide, that you can strata, that you can renovate, that you can do all of those sort of things. Now, finding bargains, if you want to find bargains nowadays, the three big ones that I look for are termite damage, flood damage, fire damage. Now, you're going to have to have cash for a lot of some of those, and that's where you're going to get a bargain. So your confidence has been that you've seen capital growth. You need to now get confidence in actually manufacturing your growth. That's the important part for you now, Kyle. All right. Now, that's the questions for that have come in today. Now, what I'm going to do is, so the questions that you will now see, you won't see now, are ones that I'm actually reading out. And so, you know, so don't send in, I can't see the question. It's because I'm reading it out. Someone's actually sent it in. Okay. Pancaj has said, if I open one trustee company and have three properties in the trust, if someone sued me, all the properties at risk. Absolutely. So if you've got three properties sitting in one trust and a tenant trips over in one property and wants to sue, all of the equity that's available in the other two and that one property is up for grabs. So you've got to be very careful about that. Are there property managers that look after room by room, and what would be a fair percentage to pay? Okay, there are property managers around that will look after room for room basis. You know, Lee on the Sunshine Coast has found one that is quite happy to do it. You're going to have to do some ringing around. They're going to be they're few and far between. You're going to have to talk to them about that. And essentially, they've got a bit more work. So, you know, you take Mark and Amanda, the two Platinums, they charge 30% to look after someone else's property, but they find the tenant for it and they do all the work that's involved in that. And you might say 30%, that's absolutely crazy. But when you look at the properties that they look after, it, then a normal house will rent for $350, but they're going to be pulling in $1,000 plus a week in rent if they're managing the property for you. It's an interesting scenario because, you know, we're always on the scout and looking out for properties, and we've found a property on the Sunshine Coast that has had a marriage split up and it's going to the courts, and we put an offer in on it under terms, and the bank actually recently came back to us and said, well, we were actually looking at it as a PPR, but the bank just came back to us and said, oh, look, we're interested. Now, we found another property to buy, so we said, well, we could probably do this. It's 4-bedroom, 4-bathroom, so Thursday night, we lifted all the photos off the internet and we put Gumtree ads in. And we put ads in at, so a standard rental in the area would probably pull in $450, maybe $500. And we put some ads in for $250 a room, $200 a room to see what would come in. In the space of 12 hours, we had about seven people wanting to rent the rooms at $250, from $200 up to $250. So that's a difference of $850 for that house versus $500. Now, remember, you've got to pay for electricity and everything that goes around that. That's my take on it. I think that you could either find them through Gumtree yourself or do a lot of ringing around. Now, you're going to get a lot of agents that are going to say, oh, no, there's no market for that. I'm going to say one word that's a bit rude, bullshit. There is a heap of market for it. I'm yet to have a student come back to me that's put a Gumtree ad in and said, oh, look, there's no market. No one's ringing up. So for me, try the market, you know, put your ads in Gumtree. They'll ring up and you say, oh, sorry, the room's taken, but at least you know that the demand is there. Wow, this is a long one. Hi, Ian. A question for later tonight, possibly. I'm looking at building a second home for the purpose of cash flow on a family-owned property that is zoned as rural. I've been told by the council I'm able to construct a second dwelling subject to approval. There are some issues such as remnant vegetation and koala habitat on the property. Jesus. Would you advise engaging a town planner as a very first step to liaise with the council versus requesting a meeting with the council's in-house town planner? Any guide on initial cost of a town planner to give you their thoughts on a project's viability? Look, I don't believe that if you haven't got the experience, talking to a town planner direct from the council may not do you any justice. You can get lots of town planners that can give you feedback on what can be done without any charge. And some of them will charge. You know, I've got a planner in Sydney that will charge me $900 every time I ask him to look at something, but I know that he's going to look at it and tell me whether I can or can't do what I want to do on there. You might be able to talk to a private certifier depending on which state you're in, and they would be able to give you some good feedback around what you can and can't do on that block too. And there are some good architects and designers that will be able to give you some feedback as well. If you think the town planner is going to help you out, go for it. But remember, what you say can be used against you down the track. Regarding sewerage, when there is potential subdivision, what do we need to be aware of that? How many meters from sewerage can be tolerated? Essentially, what you're going to need in a subdivision is, if you're going to subdivide, you're going to need a main sewerage connection on each block. So if you don't have sewerage on there, you're going to have to find the nearest main and bring it into the block. If the main is running through the block, you're going to have to cut a junction in, which costs money. So every area is different. You're going to have to talk to either the council or the water provider in the area and work from that. From Nolene, very excited. I've just purchased my first property in regional Victoria on a 1,200 square meter block with a completely renovated period home and room to build two units. How exciting, Nolene. It's great to hear those stories. And I'm sure you've done a very good feasibility and making sure that it's working in your favor. So congratulations. From Valerie, what do you think of kit home versus prefabricated versus removable house? And how are these perceived by councils in New South Wales? Look, every council, there's 141 councils across the country, and they've all got different views. Now, let me talk you through the funding models. With a kit home, you can usually get funding for those because, you know, or the kit home company will have to build in a bit of a buffer until you get your first payment in. So prefabricated or modular homes, you're going to need most of the time upfront payment for them before they leave their factory. Now, remember, there is a student called Mark Hodge who I haven't used yet, so you're going to have to do your own research on him. He's posted in the website that he's, I think it's called Built Smart is the name of the company, and they will actually fund it until you get it on the block. As long as you've got a pre-approved loan for the construction, they will get it out of their factory, put it on your block, and you can pay them out. Removable houses, the sting got taken out of them a fair bit because you now have to bring them up to sustainability with energy efficiency with glass and hot water heaters and rewiring and all that sort of stuff. So by the time you've actually taken a removable house and put it on a block, restumped it, done all the cladding and all that, it doesn't usually end up that much far behind a normal stuff. So councils in New South Wales, ask the planners. I mean, that they can't knock it back. And in New South Wales, if you're putting a something onto a block of land, you actually most of the time don't have to involve the council because you can use a private certifier to get the approval done in 10 days. So sometimes, most of the time, it's not the council's. Council can't do anything about it anyway. Stephen, is there an expired date of DA approval of subdivision of the land or house? Can we modify or change to different type of potential duplex? Not according to previous DTAs. If you get a DA approval across the country, it's relatively the same. 4 years is usually what it says it, but it'll state it on the approval of the subdivision that this will be from the date of approval, 4 years. You can seek extensions for them. You can do what they consider a major, what do they call it? It's a start to the project. So major, far out, I'm losing the words at the moment. But you've actually started the project, and then you can, then they can't take that away from you because you've actually paid the fees, you've you know, done the building application, and you've made some movements. I know a house that did footings, and 12 years later they started building the rest of the house. So you know, you can get away with that. You can ask for extensions. It'll all depend. When it comes to modifying or changing, that'll come down to the council whether you can request to change the approval. It might be a full approval process. If you're changing it significantly, it's going to be a new application. Hi, Ian. We've recently gone through a refinancing process and the broker we're using is giving us a document to sign stating that if we refinance again without in 18 months, we have to pay the broker a callback amount of around $2,900. Is this normal and would you sign it? Yeah, look, what happened was in the past was that the mortgage brokerage companies would charge break fees and all the rest of it. Then the federal government said, no, you can't do that. You can't charge people that want to get out of a loan money. So we're not allowing you to do that anymore. And the loan company says, oh, okay, no problem. So all they did then was they took the money back from the brokers that they paid the brokers so that they ended up square. So the clawback is definitely an issue for us. You don't have a choice though, and you've got to be careful of the deals that you're going to do. So if you're going to go and do a renovation deal and you know that you're going to sell it within 18 months, understand there's going to be a clawback of $2,900 and that has to go into the feasibility. And there's been a few people getting caught on this one. I would always ask my broker, is there a clawback on this one if I sell it within 18 months or I refinance within 18 months? Okay. Now, the refinance, if you're using the same broker, is generally not an issue. It's only if you refinance to another broker. So if you bought a property and you did something to it and then you refinance to another lending company with the same broker, well, that broker would have a clawback of $2,900, but then he'd get paid for the new one. So just establish with him, Carolyn, that if you refinanced with him, whether he would still ask for the clawback of $2,900. For Shan's question, would you use both husband and wife as a pointer and controller? Yeah, that's correct. So husband and wife would become appointers, and then husband would be beneficiary and director of one, and then the wife would be director and beneficiary of another company and trust. Ian, can the capital loss be used to offset against a capital gain that I receive as a distribution from one of my other trusts? I don't believe so, because a distribution is an income. So you can't distribute capital gains or capital losses between trusts. They have to stay in the trust. For you personally, I don't think you can, because a distribution from a trust is an income. You may need to check that with your accountants. I'm not fully 100% on the top of that. So I would ask that of the people that can answer it correctly and qualified. Your advice on fire, termite, flood is good. We bought a minor fire damage for $70,000 cash and spent $30,000. It just revalued today for $140,000, a nice little chunk deal from my brother and I. So you spent $100,000, revalued at $140,000, got all your money back and more. I'm just going to send you, Jared, I'm just going to send you my email address because I wouldn't mind seeing some photos on that so that we could, if you don't mind, you don't have to, no pressure here. So I've just sent that to you privately so that you can send it to me and we can we can put some slides together, because that's always a great deal, you know. And I don't know what sort of rent you got coming in, but you need $200 a week for that to be positive geared. And, you know, so you've got another property in your portfolio. In 10 years' time, that's going to be worth, you know, probably $280,000. And I'm glad, Jared, that you listened to what I said a few months ago when you went out and did it. From Michael, strata or subdivision, is it better to do one more than the other from a cost point of view? When it comes to strata or subdivision, what you have to look at is your financing, okay, and whether you can afford to do it. Strata is going to be quicker and easier. With a strata, when you're doing a build, though, you're going to have to have your finance, and you're going to have to build the whole lot before you can actually split it up and split the titles up into the body corporate and the strata title. With a subdivision, though, when you split the land, you can then lift the titles and you've got instant value then right there in your hand. And then you can go off. It takes longer and the bank has to be involved in that process. And then you go off and doing that way. So it's subdivision will normally give you more value because you've got free titles, but it does take longer. Subdivision is better because it gives you value immediately. Strata is quicker and easier, and you can do it down the track. Would Lee be happy to share details? No, I can't do that, unfortunately. Sorry. You're going to have to do the ring around yourself. So, you know, and that's part of your job. Ring around, get the feel. The more you ring around, the better the answers are going to be. Do have to get council approval for boarding for that if you rent it room by room? It'll come down to the state government's Rental Tenancy Act. It'll come down to what they consider unrelated parties and how many unrelated parties you can put in there. So, you know, you're going to have to do your own research. I do a whole section in where do I do it? I do it in extreme income. I do an hour and a half to 2 hours of rent by the room and boarding houses and rooming houses. So, Ian, can you please match the PowerPoint to the question you're discussing so I keep up with you? I've probably got a delay. Essentially, the PowerPoint basically said that if you bought in the worst period of time in Australia's purchase history, which was 1988, you still would have more than doubled the price of your property, tripled the type price of your property if you held on to it to today. So, you know, you could say that you bought at the wrong time, but if you manufacture growth in your deals, then it's not an issue. Why do we need to have a separate corporate trustee for each trust? What are the risks in having two trusts with the same corporate trustee? There's no risk of having two trusts with the same corporate trustee, except that in places like Queensland and other states, they have a tax threshold for each individual company and trust. So for land tax purposes. So if in Queensland you had a corporate trustee and trust times two, you would have the threshold in each one of those trusts. But if you had one corporate trustee with two trusts, then the total value of the land of the two trusts would come up, and then you probably would go beyond your I think it's $330,000, and you'd have to start paying land tax. When building a granny flat and renting it to someone, how are electricity and gas charges? Do I need to install separate meters? Do they go under different billings or not? It'll depend on what state you're in and what the approval is. So in some states you can build a granny flat, but you can't rent it to someone other than someone in your family. In New South Wales, for example, I would say electricity split it up definitely, and gas definitely as well. Too hard to do it any other way. So you just got to be wary of the fact that you have approval to actually rent it to someone else, that the granny flat is approved. And if that's the case, I would always separate the meters. And yes, you do have to install a separate meter. Now, if you haven't got approval, the electricity company won't give you the approval to separate the meter. From Ben, I'm keen on property out Whoop Whoop that's resi-mercial and currently has tenants on month-to-month lease where owner is paying all rates, bad lease. Right. Owner says he can negotiate a three-year lease with high rental and can transfer the additional garbage pickup to tenant. Again, shocking lease. Should I opt in to guaranteed tenant on a 3-year long, slightly better lease, or should I buy it and then organise my own lease with possibility of losing current tenant? Do you think I could get a better deal, negotiate better if I buy it on the bad lease? That's entirely up to you, really. You're going to have to risk the fact that you may lose a tenant if you're going to go in there and do that. Now, if the tenant, it depends on the tenant too. If the tenant is really badly organized and he's got stuff everywhere and it's going to be an absolute nightmare for him to or her to move, then you're in a better negotiating position. At the same token, the numbers speak the game. So what is it that you can do to pay? If it's just a cash flow property, what are the numbers showing? If it's a property that you want to manufacture growth in, how does that tenant fit into the manufactured growth perspective of the property? You know, it might be fine for them to sign a 3-year lease. If you've got a lease in place, which is current, there won't be any GST on it. So that's a good thing. So you look, there's a lot of stuff that you're going to have to look at there. I can't recommend whether you negotiate or not. It's going to come down to a numbers game. If it was me, I would be looking at the tenant, look at what the availability of other tenants in the same town is. And if there is vacancies all over the place for a residential style property, then I wouldn't be risking it too much. Just got to think about that. Just starting out, can you go into a bit more detail on the trust company structure required and the possible tax implications, depreciation costs for the trust? Look, if you go into the FAQ sections on the website, there's plenty of information about that on the frequently asked questions, and you've got your two coaches, Michael and Sarah, and they're very helpful. I think going through it here without any drawings or diagrams would be difficult, and it's something that's part of your learning package, and I'm not brushing you off. I'm just saying that there is some good FAQs that the coaches have put together. Hi, Ian. I'm looking at a place which is over 600 meter block plus a house and garage. I'm thinking of modifying the garage and making it self-contained granny flat is already has a shower, WC and a sink plus an insulated and being used as a flat already. Doesn't mean it's legal. I'm hoping to add a room and put in a kitchen. I've checked with council and they said provided I can meet private open space and a car park requirement, I should be able to get planning approval for it. Should I consult with a builder about my cost here or should the council give me a list of requirements and try to nut out my costs? I would seriously be looking at a good architect. Well, a planner is a private town planner is who I would be getting to look at it first, and then a building inspector to make sure that it actually meets building code requirements, that it's got the correct height and all the rest of it. And yes, I would be consulting multiple builders to make sure that you'll know what it's going to cost to do what you're going to do before you go buying anything. Jared, should I admit that I already had your email? Go away. I can't scroll down. I'm actually reading these questions out. These are questions that have come in tonight. We bought a property in Kalgoorlie with existing earthquake damage. Okay, Tanya, that's all you're saying. You'll have to give me some more information. Hi, Ian. Zoran and Susie here. Zoran and Susie, the millionaire makeover people from the last boot camp. We were thinking of turning our PPR into single room rental or two flats. It's a two-story with 5 bedrooms, 3 lounges and 4 toilets. Jeez, it's a big house, Zoran. We want to hang on to this home forever, basically. What do you think? Okay, so I've got to remember where you're from, Zoran. I think you're from Sydney, from memory. Wollongong is where you're from. Look, if you're going to turn it into two flats, it has to be approved as two flats. Now, having a two-story, five-bedroom home with 3 lounges and 4 toilets, there's nothing stopping you from converting internally part of the house into a granny flat. Now, there's going to be fire rating stuff that you're going to have to look at. I would ring George from grannyflatbuilders.com. George from grannyflatbuilders.com. He knows heaps about granny flats. And I would be considering turning your two-story house into two units. So 60 square meters downstairs where you could get possibly two or three rooms in and then a four-bedroom or whatever out there because you've got lounge rooms and stuff all over the place. Now, like I said, fire rating is going to be important and you're going to have to look at that. that's what I would be doing, and renting by the room. Well, you got to know what your limit is. Now, in New South Wales, I think, tell me, Zoran from Newcastle, tell me, Zoran, I think you joined Quantum, in which case you could look at converting that into a boarding house under the state government, New South Wales state government laws. And Newcastle is a great area for boarding houses. So to me, if you've got 5 bedrooms and 3 lounge rooms, you've got the possibility of probably getting 6, 7, 8 bedrooms into that property, rent it by the room, and it would be a great cash flow property for you forever. And if you are doing Quantum, when you come to extreme income and we talk about boarding houses, I've got lots more information for you on that. Ian, Kylie's parents, Gary and Julie here. Hi. You said you would like to see before the afterthoughts of the two housing renters. Okay, no worries. I will just, you finished them on Thursday. So this is a couple in Tasmania that bought some really, some from memory housing commission stuff, and they've done a quick reno on them. I'd love to see them. Just ask Kylie for the email address, Gary and Julie, and I'd love to see those photos. From Lee, hi, just another success story. Purchased a house on the coast for $295,000, reno at $35,000 and revalued at $380,000. This was completed following the guidelines learned here. This was done by my daughter and son-in-law. So Lee Whitten is a great student that I've been working with in the last year, and they've done some really great things with the properties that they've got. So again, and that's rubbing off with the whole family. So that's fantastic, Lee. Bev, we have several blocks of land, too many, and we're thinking of handing 2 back to the bank. What? Do you have any idea exactly what they will do and if this may be a good idea so that we can free up these payments for something else? Please don't say to ring the bank and ask them. That's right. I don't trust the bank either. All right, Bev, it doesn't work that way. What you're going to have to do is sell the properties and get them back to the bank. Now, I don't know if you've had a financial health check with the investor loan strategists. I would sit down and have a look at and talk to them and tell them that your scenario, and they will let you understand how the best way. So essentially what you're going to have to do is sell blocks of land and pay the mortgage back. And then that way that should free up some stuff for you if they're at 80%. Again, if you haven't had your financial health check, that's your number one priority to do it. Zoran from Newcastle, yes. Okay. Hi, and I tuned into the webinar about 15 minutes ago, and the only image on the screen is a letter from Kylie. Yeah, look, I'm reading questions out as that have come in during the night. The rest of the webinar is recorded and will be on the website in the next few days. So don't worry too much about that. Yes, you are looking at just that piece of, because I'm reading questions off a screen that you can't see. And I can't show you that screen because the GoToWebinar doesn't allow me. Hi, Ian. In asset protection, is it okay to have 2 trusts under one corporate trustee when you want to run a business and hold properties in the other? Definitely, I wouldn't do it. I think there would be risk in that. I'm not saying that it is risky, but I would consider that it would be too messy. And what you're trying to save is a nil tax return. So, you know, the setup of a company is not that much more expensive when you first set it up, and then the yearly costs are, I think, $246 or something like that to put a nil tax return in, because it hasn't done any trading, it's done nothing. So my question is, are you willing for call it $400 or $500 a year, are you willing to lose property and your livelihood just because of $500 a year? Now, I know $500 is a lot for a lot of people, but yeah, I would consider to be careful on that one. All right. So I've run out of questions that no one's asking. So I might go soon. Unless someone's got some more questions. What car are you buying? It won't be a Hummer, I can tell you that. I wouldn't be able to get up the steps to it. I'd be in the ladder. all right. So is the controller the same as the appointer? Yes, the appointer has full control of the trust. So that is that they the appointers are the people that call the director, or that can put the trustee company in, that put the directors in charge of the company, and the company then tells the trust what to do. So that's why you don't ever want anyone else, like your solicitor or anything, to be as your appointer, because they can make your life a nightmare. So yes. All right. Who needs to sell their block of lands? I don't know. If for those blocks of land, you may want to put them on the website and have a look at selling it to some students, because, you know, it may be worthy of them going and putting a transportable in there and working around there. All right, so I've got a few more questions now, and I'll just answer these and then I'll come offline. Hi, Ian, just joined the program. Trying to locate acquisition spreadsheet Dimpner mentions in the growth accelerator module to work out if property will be positive or negatively geared. Where can I find it on the website? Most of the stuff that you'll find that you need to look for on the website. And if you can't find it, you've always got your coaches there. So just let me pull it up. Got 1,000 tabs open here. So when you in here, you've got I think it's under downloads. If you look in downloads, you'll have a section. You've got lots of different things in there, and I think you're talking about the return on equity spreadsheet. And that is, just let me find it. It will be in here somewhere. If it's anywhere, it'll be here. And if you can't find it, so you've got your opportunity cost worksheet. That's whether it's worthy of keeping or selling. Your portfolio analysis is, I think, the one that you're looking for. So the portfolio analysis will tell you whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. So yeah, it's in there. Okay, I learned a lot tonight. That's a good thing. Is Port and South Hedland for house and land package still a good prospect? Please, house and land packages are only good in one circumstance. That's where you're asset rich and you've got no income. And that's the only time a house and land should be looked at for passive income. If you're buying house and land package, you're paying a developer money, you're paying a builder money, and you're paying a marketeer money. All right? We want to cut the marketeer and developer out and just pay the builder. So, so I would have to say, regardless of where it is, you don't want to try and buy a house and land package. Look, a good company in Sydney for a granny flat is just Google grannyflatbuilders.com, and George is a Dipner student. The other company is Built Smart, which is on the website here too. And there's a post from Mark Hodge on the website in there. Just buying our PPR and going to do some cosmetic redos, rather than living in it and try to reno around, what options you can suggest? Oh, harden up. God. You know, we've done some ridiculous structural renovations while we've lived in a property, and something we don't want to do again. For me, if you can't live in the property while you're renovating it, well, you're going to have to rent somewhere. So my suggestions would be that the first thing that you do is is one bedroom. Well, I don't know how many kids you had, but let's just presume you're a couple. I would do a bedroom, kitchen, and bathroom as quick as possible. And if that means you've got to move in with your parents, God forbid, do that. So that when you do go into the property to live through the renovation, at least you've got something tidy to sleep in, something tidy to bathe in, and something tidy to cook in. Then you can do the other parts of the house. Okay, Zoran, we'll see you there. When a private certifier is sufficient and when council approval is required. Sorry, Valerie, you're going to have to send the other part of the question, because I see snippets of questions with lots of people in between. I need the other part of your question, Valerie. Sorry. Jared, how do you stop the bank worrying about a second mortgage bank to the vendor when they are financing the deposit? Well, two things there. Firstly, you're going to have to show you don't want to tell the bank up front about that, because they won't give it to you. You're going to have to show funds to complete, and then you're going to have to get the legal people to talk to the bank. Now, the preference is for the vendor to put a caveat on the property. It's easier from a legal perspective, and the legal people at the bank don't freak out as much, rather than a second mortgage. So, but again, Pacific Law, talk to David Netherton. He's done a couple for me already, and he knows his stuff around that. Like I said, I can't give you anyone's name for selling the blocks, Lee. You're going to have to, hopefully they'll post it on the Ultimate website and you can look in there. In your development trust, you say you pay yourself a salary there. Does that mean you take a regular pay out of it? Yeah, no, every week, whatever. I think we're on 80. I think Christine and I are on $80,000 a year coming out of our development trust. And so every week we get paid that. Tax gets taken out and gets put to the side as pay as you go and all that sort of stuff. So so yes, I get paid the same amount every week. Are there any guidelines in the FAQs for doing a deal with a major retailer who may be interested in buying our land, or do we work through a commercial lawyer? Again, David Netherton's very good with commercial law and doing these styles of deals at Pacific Law. So get onto them at Pacific Law and they can help you out. Ian, I have some deals where I require funding support, looking for lenders to provide funds required for periods of 12 to 18 months. What is reasonable percentage? Look, you know, private money out there, people want 15% return and they want that on a monthly basis. And look, you're talking about 10%. I think I saw your post on there. I think you're posting in the wrong spot there, because anyone that's got any money to lend out is going to be out there buying property for themselves. So, you know, I see where you're coming from. The students here may say, oh, well, you know, the fact that you're giving incentives to a profit share at the back end might be a good thing. Look, you're going to have to scout around. Private money is a tough market. You know, you're going to have to find some self-managed super funds or some private lenders. You know, there are a few private lenders around, and just keep on knocking on doors. Don't stop knocking on doors, and you'll come to the right answer. I'm looking at doing the low-cost rental in Western New South Wales country areas that Dipner mentioned in Sydney. What is the planning rules that comes under? Would movables be a better option? It's going to come down to every council. And again, you're going to have to get approval for it. So, like I said, 141 councils, different planning schemes, different rules, different regulations, and, you know, very, very difficult. Okay. If you buy a block of units intending to strata title, do you pay stamp duty again on each title? No, you don't. You pay stamp duty on the initial buy, and when you split the titles, you'll have small amount of different types of stamp duty, but not property stamp duty when you separate the title. So you initially buy the block, and you'll have one stamp duty bill then, and that will be it, because the stamp duty is a transfer into your own name. I've recently found a boarding house in Cairns that we did the numbers on. It came out 20,000 cash positive. We're not in position to buy. Is anyone interested? Spotter fee 5,000 applies. Purchase price is 700. Property is commercial, all council approved. Sounds like a good deal. You are part of the Cairns group, I think, Cameron. I would look for the Cairns group and offer it to someone in Cairns. If you want, put it on the Ultimate website. Don't put addresses in. And I think the fact that you've mentioned Cairns now might hurt you. But put it on there and don't put the addresses in. Get a confirmation and email that if they do buy it, they will give you a spotter's fee and work from that. Who do you use for building insurance and landlord? I use the brokers. I use Investor Loans brokers. I have an insurance broker that looks after me. Jared saying David is very good at Pacific Law. I found a block of land which can be subdivided. Can I build a granny flat now and do subdivision in a few years later? Can the council change the DA from granny flat to subdivision? This is a very grey area, and a subdivision is a council approval, right? You could go to a certifier right now and get a house and maybe a house and granny flat approved. It'll depend if it's New South Wales, if it is New South Wales, from a private certifier. So, you know, and then down the track you could subdivide. Now, I've asked the question before that, if I bought a block of land, can I get the certifier to approve a granny flat and build the granny flat and house, and then build the granny flat first, live in that, and then build the house? Some have said, yes, we'll do that, and others have said, no, we won't do that. And by the way, there are 565 councils in Australia. I work in the government department in charge of them. Wow, that's interesting. That is a lot, isn't it, Andy? So I'll change my numbers, I promise. And that is, so that just reinforces that there's a whole set of rules that are completely different. Ian, you just mentioned a spotter's fee. What is a reasonable spotter's fee? Look, I'm going to say it here, but a spotter's fee isn't finding a link on the website and giving it to it. Spotter's fee relies on someone doing numbers and providing a feasibility and doing all the research around property, and it's a gift. So there's no, you can't claim tax on it. It's not part of your capital cost. You can't pay GST. It's simply a gift from one student to another for them helping find the property, and it would only be paid when the property's settled and it's gone through. So that's all I'm going to say around that. I'm not going to say more than that. But there's an unwritten rule around amongst students that that's what it's about. Geelong will let you build a granny flat with approval, of course, and subdivision is then a formality. Yes, Geelong is a good area for subdivisions. Last question. I've subdivided a PPR and will be building two houses. We'll keep one and transfer one to trust and then sell. When transferring a property to the trust, do I have to pay stamp duty? Thanks. All right. So the questions I've got is, okay, I have subdivided my PPR and will be building two houses, two townhouses. So does that mean, if that means you're knocking down the old house and building two new townhouses, you'll have one in your name. We'll keep one in your own name, presumably, and transfer one to a trust and then sell. Well, what if you're going to sell it, there's no use in transferring it to a trust. So I would just sell it. When transferring a property to the trust, do I have to pay stamp duty? Yes, you do, on the market value of the property. So let me put it in another way. If you were building two town, if you had to knock down your PPR and you built two townhouses, depending on how long it took you to, you know, to how long you've owned the land and how you set it all up. But let's just say in a perfect world that you bought a house and you lived in it a little while, and then you decided that you could put a townhouse on there, and you decided to move into one townhouse after you built it, and then you decided, oh, look, I don't like the sun on this side and the dog next door barks, I might sell this townhouse. It would be capital gains free and GST free, and then you could move into the other townhouse because it's on the better side that you didn't realize when you're first building. That's all I'm going to say. So consideration needs to be given to that one. All right, so that's it for me. Thanks, everyone, for being around. Remember, you can send questions to questions@realestatesuccess.com.au. That's questions@realestatesuccess.com.au. Should be back in a couple of weeks with another information webinar with Dibna. We'll probably be in China, so it'll be an interesting one. We might actually get Christine to do one on a different area as well. So see how we go there. I'm pretty sure Dibna and I will probably hook up from overseas, and we'll run it from overseas, and we'll have lots of fun. Okay, guys, have a good night. See ya.